I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Dean Moyer, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Johns Hopkins University. We're discussing his 2021 book, Hegel's Value, Justice as the Living Good, from Oxford University Press. Moyer works on Kant and German idealism, and has written a previous book on Hegel and conscience, as well as several other articles. First of all, Dean Moyer, let me say welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thanks for having me.
Dean, I loved the book. I, of course, love Hegel, so I love most stuff on Hegel, but yours was I found to be a great analysis of the philosophy of right, indeed the entirety of the philosophy of right, which is no mean feat, with a focus on the related notions of justice and value. And I'm looking forward to getting into talking about those topics with you, and also with connections to contemporary philosophy and John Rawls and Robert Brandom. So all great stuff. So thank you for the book. Let me start by asking you, as I always do, what the motivation was for writing the book.
Sure. There were really three lines of thought that came together for me when I was writing this book. Some that go way back to my dissertation work, and others that developed in working on Hegel's logic and learning from lots of other scholars of Hegel. So the first was this modern split between right and politics on the one hand and morality on the other, right? I mean, these were opposed domains by Kant and Fichte. They opposed them as external and internal freedom. And it was sort of clear as day that Hegel wanted to overcome that divide in ethical life. But his institutional system that he gives there, it's just very hard to identify as a system of justice. I mean, it feels like it ought to be, but exactly how it's supposed to do that has always been sort of unclear. So my intuition was that it would begin to make sense as such a theory once you could develop really a theory of value with the good as central. And then you can say, if you've got that on the table, that you're getting the value that you are owed. So you can give a kind of intuitive sense of justice if you can manage to get a coherent theory of value out of the book. But when you make that move, there's a worry that it can seem like Hegel becomes too much of like an ideal theorist, almost like a Rawlsian in seeing politics as the proper distribution of primary goods. And so one of the challenges I took up was to try to do justice to the realist elements in Hegel that, after all, are what make him so exciting: the tragedy, the struggle to the death, the competition in civil society, while holding on to something like an ethical core. The second kind of line of thought that motivated me kind of grew out of this exciting development in understanding Hegel's logic and method. You mentioned Brandom already, who'd given this like inferentialist reading of Hegel's semantics, holding that the content in any claim comes from rational relations or inferences. And that view is usually presented as one in theoretical philosophy. And I think it's absolutely central to Hegel. And so what I set out to show is that sort of what could be done with that inferentialism in practical philosophy. And the intuitive idea is that the meaning and the value of a right is only given through its use or through its actual expression. So that the job of the state is to ensure the conditions for the expression of right. And I mean, it's similar to what Rawls thematized as sort of the fair value of political liberty idea. And I think that idea that you can sort of think about the value of right through these inferential relations could be extended to all rights. And then the final thing that sort of came about while I was working on the basic project was a lot of new thinking about the idea of life. And the more I got into Hegel's logic, especially the end of his logic, you see how important the idea of life is. And so the subtitle of the book, Justice is the Living Good, really came about when I realized I can't avoid this. In fact, I should embrace it as sort of central to the project. That, you know, life in the organic has this, still kind of has a bad name, I think. It's maybe a bit conservative or vitalist. But, you know, I think it just goes together with Hegel's political rationalism. And he endorses life, you know, both as the bedrock of human existence and a kind of rational cycle of life. And that's really what prevents his rationalism from becoming kind of bloodless or merely logical or conceptual. So what I tried to do is sort of show how through the concept of life, he's able to incorporate conflict and contingency into a systematic conception, and that you could think of the world of value as kind of like an ecosystem. And that also when you kind of look at the really important kind of moments where there's tension and development and progression, they all involve a kind of opposition and unification of life and self-consciousness. So it's sort of stabilizing life and thought that both kind of unlocks his theory of value and gives you a route to thinking about justice as the living good.
That's great. I mean, a lot of strands that we can take up and return to. I mean, I thought maybe we could just start with the kind of central concept here, that the notion of value, or Hegel's view of value. And I thought you could talk, you know, to kind of talk through how you interpret Hegel's view of value. I mean, it's a conception that's against the kind of deontological Kantian view of worth or value, but rather a view of value that's teleological or purposive in nature, which then makes sense why you're talking about the good as something to be realized, right? So it's not not mere sort of rule bound or proceduralist justice, but it's we're aiming towards the good. So could you talk through, you know, so how you think about Hegel's theory of value?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why we don't have an account of Hegel's theory of value until now, and that's because it's kind of all over the place. In the introduction of the book, I think I give 7 different conceptions of value, and that's not exhaustive, that appear throughout the work. And so kind of pinning it down to one conception or another is really hard. And I do a little bit of work in the introduction to sort of relate it to the way that philosophers think about value today, and that it's a kind of fitting attitude or rational attitude theory of value, that's roughly how we can think about it, that people like Elizabeth Anderson have advocated. Her first book on value and ethics and economics actually has a kind of Kantian Hegelian basis to it. If you look at the reply to critics after that book came out, she actually sort of confesses to her Hegelian influence there. So there are sort of like within contemporary metaethics, ways in which you can think about Hegel's view as one that unites the kind of element of desiring, like we care about things because we have this affective relationship to things, we value them, but that you have to also figure out how to think of that valuing, caring, desiring relationship as rational. And so value has to have both elements, and that's really what I ended up developing for Hegel's view, and kind of getting back to his text, is what I call this like dual root theory of value, which says that in any claim about value, there has to be a connection to life, like the living individual desires, needs, interests, like pretty basic stuff. That's one root in life. And the other root is in thought, thinking, self-consciousness, and that the conception of value only really kind of comes into the picture once you get both of these things together. So I could say a little bit more about that just to give it a little bit more content. I mean, so among this list of 7 different kinds of value I give, the first is just things are valuable because they serve our needs, right? I mean, it's not quite like Fichte's, you probably know in the closed commercial state gives this bread theory of value, where he says we can take bread as the basic unit of value. And that's sort of like the most sort of literal, okay, value is what serves our physical needs as living creatures. But then the second conception I give is what I call the equivalence conception of value, which just says, look, value is what can be exchanged for something else. It's what's equivalent to something else. And so money is the paradigm of that kind of value. That looks like it's a really just virtual conception of what value is, that which can be converted into something else. And so even if you just look at those two, you know, first conceptions of value, you see that one is tied to something that's very basic about our living bodily existence. What we need to survive is valuable. And the other is tied to something about how we relate to each other when we exchange things. And it doesn't seem to have any specific content, but just sort of like what somebody is willing to give me for that thing. And then we have this institution of money through which we try to kind of give some form to value such that we can easily trade things with each other. So those are the initial kind of conceptions of value. But then I'll stop here in a second, but you know, then he builds up into greater and greater complexity, but then also coming up with a conception of final value. So it's not all the sense of value that we know from economics and from contracts and exchange, but he also has a conception of the value of humanity, the value of the state, and there we get into somewhat different conceptions of value. And the big challenge of the book ended up being, how do you put these two broad families of value together? One that looks kind of like a utilitarian or consequentialist version, and another that looks more Kantian or like final intrinsic value. I'll stop there.
Yeah, that's great. I found your discussion really useful in part because I find some of these debates about value kind of artificial, or ways in which Hegel has already sort of broken down some of these distinctions between sort of subjectivist and objectivist views of value, or internalist and externalist, subjective theories of the good versus objectivist theories of the good, say. I mean, what I've often found useful about Hegel is exactly what you're describing, which is that he's able to sort of mediate the, you know, sort of subjective and objective through a kind of developmental account of value, which is, you know, not developmental just simply in the sense of the growth of what we value from when we're a child through when we're an adult, but a sort of a growth of the valuing of humanity's development as well. And so I found that a kind of useful way of thinking about it that doesn't nevertheless sort of break down the tensions that exist, but sort of lead towards the development of complexity through the very way in which we try to wrestle with these tensions. So, I mean, which leads, of course, I think to this, the sort of inferentialism, the other sort of contribution of the book, as you say in the introduction, that Hegel's teleological approach to value is a form of teleological inferentialism, which again, essentially, I take it what you're doing is, well, you're taking seriously Hegel's logic, which a lot of people in Hegel scholarship haven't done in a while. So that's a good thing, I find, because Hegel himself takes seriously his own logic and philosophy of right. But you're also reading his logic through the lens of Robert Brandom, whom we've already mentioned, who himself who developed this sort of inferentialist approach, but also has written himself a lot about Hegel. Could you, if possible, give us a kind of primer on, I realize this is a difficult task, but how should we think about, the inferentialist approach to practical reasoning, which is, Brandom developed this first in the context, as you say, of the philosophy of language, but you're sort of taking it up in the practical domain. So how should we think about the sort of inferentialist philosophy here, and how do you apply it to Hegel's thought?
Yeah, so I mean the idea that of inferentialism can be hard to get your head around because it's not entirely clear up front like what it's an account of. And I think it's important, like in the Brandom story, he wants to say it's an account of semantic content. So this notion that there's something called content, like what is the content of a judgment or what is the content of a claim? And that that is something that we can get, or can, we can think that we can get in a number of different ways. And so usually the inferentialist story that he and others tell when it comes to, you know, epistemology and semantics is that you might think the content of a claim comes from some directly perceived item in the world, right? It's because you have sort of the evidence for it right in front of you that your claim about something has content. And that that would be a kind of form of immediacy. And his goal, and again, this follows Charles Sanders Peirce and Wilfred Sellers and others, is to say, no, the content of any claim, yes, it gets part of its content from those circumstances in which you use the claim. So if you, you know, can point out something and then make that claim, then that's part of its content. But then you also want to say, well, what are the, what sorts of other kind of arguments and inferences can you get out of that claim? So where does it lead you to? And it, so it's, you can see how it kind of naturally is a thought at the root of American pragmatism, where you want to say that, well, the value of a claim is, you know, what it does for you, what difference it makes, what you can do with it, those sorts of claims. And so it's also aligned sometimes with Wittgenstein's claim that meaning is use. So the meaning of something is really what you can do with it or how it's used in a language. And so in theoretical philosophy, those claims can seem revolutionary and interesting if you have a kind of baldly empiricist account and you think, oh my God, actually that what empiricists have been telling us about what claims mean is actually totally wrong. We need to enter into this rationalist domain where it's about the kind of rationality of the inferences that use any sort of claim as part of their network of relations and inferences. In practical philosophy, the case is a bit different because we're used to thinking about practical issues and rights and politics and law as questions of practical reasoning or making inferences, right? So it might not seem like surprising that you would have an inferentialism in the practical domain, because that's just like what constitutional lawyers do, is they take a claim that is given there, let's say in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, in a very simple form, and then they say, well, how are we supposed to interpret this? What really are the consequences for specific cases of this very simple claim, right? So I think the theory hasn't really been developed in the practical domain, in part because it's so obviously part of the practical realm that you just don't think, aha, inferentialism, that's going to be doing something radically new in the practical domain, since what we do when we're making arguments in about the law and about ethics is to draw inferences and make arguments. So that's part of the background to this, to say, well, what really is the value added in a way of calling this inferentialism? And so the point that I pick up on really is that has to do with sort of like rights and their use. Like if we think about like meaning as use for various concepts, we think of rights and their use, or rights and their actuality. And so Hegel has long been famous for these claims about the rational and the actual, and there's lots of debates over what exactly that means. And the way I'm reading it is to say that like a right is only as valuable as its actual expression, right? So if you have a right to property, but no opportunity to own property, like you have a right to it, but you don't actually have any, then that right is not worth anything. And so you can start with what Hegel calls abstract rights, like as a human being, I have this capacity to own stuff. But once you cast it in this inferentialist context, all the demands on that right are give that right meaning, give that right value by providing contexts for the expression of that right. And it's through that sort of logic that Hegel then can move you from a very immediate claim about the right to property to saying that actually we need to have situations of contract. Actually, we need to develop these more universal kind of wills. And then we need this whole system of institutions that he develops in ethical life. So in essence, it's a way of saying that like nothing, like no immediate rights claim is going to have value or meaning without this kind of rich expressive context in which you can actually successfully make practical inferences. And I should say, I'm really focused on practical inferences, which is why it's, you know, a bit different from Brandom's view. And that means mostly you've got a purpose, you need means to realize that purpose, and then you need to carry that purpose out. And there's just an incredible amount that you can do with Hegel's philosophy with just that basic purpose, means, realized action structure.
Yeah, I find this all fascinating because it reminds me a little bit of, you know, Robert Pippin wrote an article many years ago about you know, the logical structure of the philosophy of right, in which the idea is to, you know, the positing of something that we take to be of value, and then the checking to see whether or not that value can be instantiated or not, whether it can be realized, and if it can or if it can't, then we have to think through positing of further kinds of values in order to realize. So it's not just a matter of thinking about sort of value or rights in the abstract, but to think in terms of their realization as well. And that's, you know, so that's how you get this development of Hegel's entire system in the philosophy of right. And added to that, I mean, I think that this is the other sort of interesting thing that you bring out. I mean, the added value of inferentialism here is not that you might think that there's only one means to realize any one end, but the sort of contextual character of Hegel's philosophy allows for there to be many, many different paths towards the realization of a value, right? So it's a little bit later in the book, you talk about Hegel's positivism, or argue that Hegel is a kind of positivist because there's the application of certain kinds of principles can be realized in multiple different ways, depending on the sort of society or state that you're living in. So, I mean, did you want to walk through a little bit of, I mean, maybe give an example from Hegel to make this a little bit more concrete? I think you started to talk about the abstract right section, but if you want to sort of take us through a little bit in abstract right, yeah, to think sure, about, I mean, how this yeah, works.
Right. I mean, I'll tell you that, you know, there's three sort of really key points, and maybe I'll just mention the first two and then we can get to the third if you want. What I wanted to do in writing this book, one of the things was to give like a argumentative template, because, you know, there's lots of things in the philosophy of right that you can understand at the kind of general intuitive level, you know, kind of unlike a lot of other Hegel texts, in the philosophy of right, you kind of know what he's talking about. We have these lecture notes that give us a lot of help in like trying to figure out where he gets from one topic to another. But then there are these incredibly important transitions from abstract right to morality, from morality to ethical life. And then within the morality section, from welfare to the good, where he seems to make a very strong appeal to his logic, and sometimes even explicitly says that, but then he doesn't really give it to you. He just sort of says, and of course, if you've understood anything about the logic, you'll understand why we have to make the next move. And so one of my goals in the book was to sort of give what I call a basic argument that captures at least those three main transitions. It captures some other stuff too, but at least those three main transitions, which are really what, you know, give the book its kind of systematic importance, is to figure out how he gets from one to the other and connects them all, even before we get to the full theory of institutions, which is sort of like the second half of the book in ethical life. And so what I wanted to do, and maybe this will help kind of say what the inferentialism actually comes to in Hegel's text, to say a little bit about like the transition from crime and punishment to morality. That's the sort of first big transition in the text. And all these transitions come about through a certain like violation of right, right? And that's, you know, in a way, one of the big problems with, you know, studying Hegel's political philosophy or frustrations is you get these incredibly, you know, especially in the Phenomenology of Spirit, you get these incredibly pregnant moments in uses of literature, Antigone, Diderot, other places, and they seem to have this incredible sort of revolutionary potential. And you get to the philosophy of right, and you're like, wow, this looks so really ideal, and what happened to all those exciting things from the Phenomenology? And what I think happens is they get put into these logical transitions. And so this modeling of the basic argument is supposed to capture like that conflict and incorporation of contingency that appears in lots of other places in Hegel, but is hard to sort of spot in the philosophy of right. So he has this moment in Abstract Right of crime, right? So we're going along doing property rights, contract, and then we get crime. And he seems to present crime as a sort of necessary moment in the development of the will. And so one of the issues is sort of like, where does that moment of crime come from? Like, it doesn't seem like it just happens to be that way because we're not perfect beings. It seems to actually be generated from Abstract Right itself. And so one of the things I want to say is that like, the starting point for this argument through crime to morality is to say something like, all right, you're living in a system that all you have is property rights. You've got a free will, there are property rights, you can contract people. And then what is missing in this picture? And the moment of crime is supposed to be a kind of violation of those norms that then brings out something that was latent or something that was missing really in the basic abstract right that came before that. And so in his sort of logical terms, right, Hegel does everything in terms of these universality, particularity, individuality, the three moments of the concept. In his terms, the moment of crime is the moment of the particular will. So there's something about us as particular beings that have this particular sort of conglomeration of attributes and that rebels against this mere regime of abstract right and violates it, commits a crime. And that's a consequence in a way, as Hegel sort of sets it out, that's a consequence of the abstractness of the right itself. And so you look at that violation and then what comes after it, punishment that's supposed to sort of revisit that harm on the person who committed it. And that, what I try to show in this basic argument is that both the crime and the punishment have the same form, and therefore the punishment is just as much a reflection of the inadequacy of the whole shape as the crime. And that what Hegel's saying there is that the whole scene has to shift in order to incorporate these consequences in a way that won't just reproduce the problem. And that's what kind of switches the account or pushes the account over into morality, where you get all three moments, not just individuality and universality, but the particular subjective will as also essential to right. And that's what's different about the domain of morality. So that's the first version of this argument.
Just briefly. Just on that, because this is often wondered about this transition in the philosophy of right. I mean, is the crime and the punishment the same because they're both carried out by individuals, that is particular wills? Right, so that they don't carry because you might think the punishment, well, if you have a wise judge who, you know, can weigh in on this particular crime, why is that just the same as someone who commits a crime? Well, because it's carried out by a particular will. It doesn't have the character of the whole community behind it or something like that. Is that the idea?
That's definitely part of the idea. I mean, he brings back the whole scene of justice and punishment in ethical life, where you do have the whole community and lawfully appointed judges and so on. But I think at the beginning in Abstract Right, there is no such figure of a judge. Like, it's just the kinsmen out for revenge, basically, who are the ones carrying out this punishment. And I mean, one thing I try to bring out in the book is that, you know, this is one moment where you can contrast Hegel with the classical social contract theory and say, okay, well, they had this moment too, right? That's what happens in the state of nature when you don't have civil society yet. You have everybody kind of exercising punishment themselves on others, and we need to give that up in this, submit to a sovereign and so on. And if Hegel had gone from Abstract Right to ethical life, he would be like a social contract theorist. And so the key is like figuring out why he makes this detour through morality and then what the consequences are of that detour for his overall theory. Because it certainly means that, like, if you compare him even to Kant and Fichte and their doctrines of right, it means that he has a much more robust conception of justice because he has built this very strong moral ideal into the very fabric of ethical life, rather than holding right to one side and morality to another. He's going to actually integrate morality within this political picture. And that's why I said at the beginning of the book, I say there's a lot of ambiguity around that. Does that make him like a moralizing political theorist who's just saying politics is applied morality? Or can he both have that moral dimension and maintain this kind of realist, I'm actually talking about politics and conflict sort of bite to it? But yeah, one of the reasons, kind of going back to your question, finally, one of the reasons, you know, the difference between his setup and, you know, Hobbes or Locke or somebody who's like trying to figure out, trying to go directly from this scene of conflict to the sovereign, is that Hegel doesn't take for granted that at that moment of Abstract Right, anybody's really in a position to have the kind of obligations or enter into the kind of relations of obligation that you would want to have in a full-blown social contract theory. So he thinks all these social contract theorists make this move, but that there's something missing. Like, we don't really know why these wills are actually obligated. Is some mere act of consent going to move them from potential criminals to great citizens? Like, there's something missing there. And I think that's part of why he then interjects the whole domain of morality as a kind of stage on the way to full-blown ethical life.
Right. I mean, unless you have a, you know, just a straight up modus vivendi, you know, or like prudential approach to political order, where it's sort of self-interest rightly understood to obey the law, which clearly, you know, somebody like a Locke does not hold to. I mean, you have to develop a you know, view like natural law, which Locke develops. But then the question becomes, where do you get that from, right? So then you have to give some kind of account. And so that's makes sense as to why, you know, you need that moral moment of morality to sort of generate that.
And then, you know, within morality, it's also not that simple. And really when I was first sort of working out this reading of the philosophy of right, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, I presented this case for the right of necessity, right? That comes right in the middle of that morality section, that he raises this question about, you know, if you're starving, is it justified to steal somebody's property in order to survive? And it's a really unusual moment. I mean, lots of people talk about the right of necessity, but nobody makes it so like central to the whole book. Because after that, and he uses, I'll say a little bit about that in a second, but he uses that to introduce his conception of the good, which is like his overall abstract conception of value. And then the rest of the book can be really read as, how do you realize value, or how do you realize the good? So, and it was suggested to me 5 or 6 years ago that I was reading the philosophy of right instead of a three-part book as a two-part book, with the actual central break right there at the right of necessity, because at that point you get the integration of right and morality into a single conception, and the rest of the book is just like, how do you realize the good? I mean, I don't think that's quite right, but it's true that he has almost like a small M version of morality, and then the good, which is like the big sort of Kantian version of morality that comes after the right of necessity. So I'd say a couple things about that, like how that works, because right when once you get claims about this, you know, the beginning of that chapter is mostly about the subjective will, about the right of intention, about why you should be able, why you have a right to find satisfaction in your actions, why you have a right to welfare, your own welfare. And it looks like what I call, I mean, he refers explicitly to subjective value there. And he says that's subjective value. And then once we get to the good, that's universal value. So a lot of the interest for me in that section was like, all right, he's using these terms about value, and he's making the move from subjective interest value to universal value right there in the middle of the book through the right of necessity. And sort of figuring out how that works became like this obsession that, again, I think I solved through this notion of the basic argument, which I think of as this inferentialist claim. So the idea with the right of necessity is, okay, you've got abstract property rights from the first part of the book. Now you've developed the right of welfare of the individual, which is basically the right to life. I mean, he says that fairly clearly, like you have a right to live, and that's part of morality. Like it's interesting because life had come up earlier in the book too, like in within abstract right. And so he brings up life again as part of morality in a way that allows him to say, you have a right of right to life against abstract right. So he then, he sort of generates the situation in which we now have a conflict between abstract right to property and then the right to live as a claim of welfare, a claim of morality. And he generates this conflict between them. And he says, you know, this is famously denies that St. Crispin had a right to steal from the poor and steal from the rich to give it to the poor. But then he turns around in the next paragraph and says, however, if you're starving, you totally have a right to steal from somebody who has property because you'll be dead. That's all of your right. Whereas you're just taking something limited from the person who has the property. So a lot of people have seen this as a really kind of pregnant kind of social welfare, like maybe even socialist kind of idea right in the middle of the philosophy of right, because it's Hegel saying abstract property rights are not absolute. Everybody has a right to live, and that overrides any limited property right. And so this seems, and I think to a certain extent does open up a case for a strong sense of justice, both in individuals of conscience, but then later when we get to the state, to say, yeah, we don't have to take property rights as absolute. We need to take the welfare of people and public welfare as the key to justice. And without that argument within morality, through the right of necessity, you're not going to get there.
Yeah. So but how does he get from the right to necessity to the good? I guess that's the puzzling thing, right? Because the right to necessity is sort of a you know, satisfying our most basic needs, whereas the good is, you know, the comprehensive satisfaction of all our needs. So, because, you know, somebody like a Locke or a Kant or a Fichte could certainly get behind, even though Kant licenses a great amount of inequality in society, he's still a supporter of welfare rights and the metaphysics of morals. So, you know, so how do you get from the right to necessity up there to the good?
Yeah, well, what he says there is that what the right of necessity shows is that abstract property rights are contingent. And he thinks the fact that you're even in a position of needing to invoke a right of necessity shows that welfare is contingent. So what he does is to say, look, these are these are rights. And so they, you know, by their very definition, they have a certain kind of necessity to them. They're claims you can make against other people. But it all has to do with what are the as I call them, expressive conditions of these rights. You know, they can seem, because of the way he's developing the account as kind of formal and abstract, they can seem like they bring their conditions with them. They're just like, everybody's got to follow these rights. Like, these are requirements on everybody who has a free will. But by pitting them against each other, he brings out the fact that nothing in those rights themselves secures the conditions of their expression, or in this language of inferences, sort of guarantees that you'll be able to conclude practical inferences based on your claim to practical, or your claim to abstract property rights, or your claim to welfare. And so what the right of necessity is supposed to show is that they're both, in essence, contingent, and therefore in need of some further structure that would, you know, bring them into a whole in which they can be seen as kind of necessary moments of that whole, right? So this is, you know, again, one of these really central kind of Hegelian moves that are so hard to get your head around, is to say, well, what does that mean? I mean, this notion of like referring to a whole. And if you look at what he says about the good right there when he introduces it, it's really just a list of the four major claims to right that he's introduced up to that point in the text. And what he wants to say there is, you know, you have to, anytime you're making a claim for anything, let's just take welfare and property, you can't make a claim to property in abstraction from the claim of the welfare of others, right? And you can't make a claim for your own welfare in abstraction from the claims of the property rights of others. So it's like saying, like, these claims are not self-standing on their own. They have to refer to other normative claims, because on their own, they lead to these conflicts and puzzles and so on. So at the beginning, it's just a kind of bringing that all into this holistic claim that then has to undergo, you know, then we have to figure out, well, how do we realize a holistic unity? Like, can't we just like, does it mean we're just like picking and choosing from the different components? No, it can't mean that. So we have to then figure out how something like the good as an abstract collection of things, of claims, can be satisfyingly realized. I mean, and just to pick up one other point that you had mentioned, the most puzzling of the things included in the in that first description of the good is a claim about contingency, right? So it's not just the abstract right, welfare, and subjectivity of knowing. It's also the contingency of external existence. That's part of the good. And so I don't think people have really appreciated how important that contingency of external existence is to the rest of the book. I mean, I think it does lead to certain claims, like about the law, that look, external existence is contingent. We shouldn't try or imagine that we can have a political system that overcomes all contingency. It's much more a question of like managing the contingency, or, you know, ceding to it a certain place, or giving it a certain respect, or organizing ourselves and how we relate to each other in light of the fact that we're going to see things differently because of our contingent relation to the external world. So I think you can get things that are sort of like, you know, Rawlsian burdens of judgment, and things that put a certain limits on what we think reason can do in the political domain, even out of this basic claim about contingency and the good.
Let's shift over to ethical life then, because this is the longest section in the philosophy of right, as folks well know. And it's where Hegel develops this notion of the good from its initial sort of abstract phase when you come in on morality. The notion of ethical life and how it, you know, I mean, there's some notorious things that Hegel says about ethical life and the introduction to it, that ethical life is, you know, substance to which individuals are all accidents. And that's obviously been the sort of focus of a misreading for a while, that it, you know, individuals are unimportant or something like that. But it, you know, if you could introduce us to you know, how you read Hegel's notion of ethical life in the inferentialist terms that you do, and maybe you can discuss the, you know, the idea of the family, for example, as an as to sort of give this more concreteness.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I didn't spend as much time on those passages, although I do talk about a couple of the central ones in this book, partly because my first book was on conscience and Hegel, and they're really part of the same project. But that first book was saying that it looks like conscience plays no role once we get out of morality, that it's just a sort of minor figure at the transition from morality to ethical life, and that Hegel seems to write it off at that point in favor of kind of participation in social institutions, and there's nothing really left for your conscience to do. So I tried to make an argument against that misreading by pointing out all the places where Hegel seems to give conscience a pretty substantial role, even in ethical life, and all the places in the phenomenology where it seems like he's writing it off, but he's not. But it's true that in the Philosophy of Right itself text, he seems almost to revel in this sense that we've made a move that now subordinates the merely particular individual to the social substance. And I mean, there's a bunch of things to say there. One thing that I've, you know, in a case that I've made in the past and do to some extent in this book too, is to say that even though Hegel's referring to powers of ethical life, and this makes you think of something like the all-powerful sovereign just sort of trampling on the rights of individuals, in fact, he's referring to the good. And so it's kind of, that may not be that comforting to some people, because it may seem like that's too metaphysical a picture of value, that to say, well, really he's talking about the rule of value over the world, not like the rule of arbitrary princes over the world. But I do think it helps to see what the systematic project is, namely the rule of justice. Because after all, when we're arguing for just social orders, we have to say what justice is. When we do that, we're going to invoke various conceptions of value, and we're going to have to give some account for those. And they are probably going to end up looking kind of like what Hegel says about the good. And so, yes, it's true, he kind of goes overboard with some of his language that suggests various nefarious things. But in fact, I think he's really just trying to say, there's an impersonal account of the value of social institutions, that we are now, by virtue of belonging to those institutions, subordinate to, and that our arbitrary will doesn't disappear. It, in fact, is given lots of room within those institutions, but ultimately is subject to law, the laws that govern those institutions, and the aims of those institutions, which will involve things like the welfare of all. And so, those are claims that I think most theories of justice are going to want to keep in some form or another. I mean, the language of substance itself is actually a really interesting case. I mean, I try not to, it's always a challenge to avoid letting the book become a book on metaethics or metaphysics or, you know, the more abstract things. If you keep burrowing into what these terms actually mean, you could go on a, you know, 10-page excursus on substance in Hegel. But they're even within, to get to the family in a second, even within the family, he is talking about the family as substance. And then he says parenthetically, oh, and by the way, substance is only the relation of the accidents to each other. And this, I think, is actually a really good, even though it still seems kind of mysterious, is actually a really good instance of the way in which Hegel uses these kind of robust and seemingly ominous metaphysical terms only to turn around and say, actually, what we mean by substance is a certain sort of set of relations of individuals to each other within a unit, the family, governed by law. So, and again, if you can go back now, and it's really exciting how much great work is being done in the logic right now. Look at what he says about substance in the logic and pry out the sense in which, yeah, it's not like there's some mysterious entity that is outside of appearance that's controlling the appearance, or, you know, that's obfuscating things, but rather what substance is when you look at it is these relations of the individuals to each other. And then calling them inferential relations, as I do, is just to say, look, there are certain patterns of action, if you want, practical syllogisms, ways in which certain purposes are connected to certain means in the realized actions. But yeah, to say a little bit more specifically about the family, I mean, so that the picture that I turn to in chapter 5, I call the section How to Build a Living Institution, right? Because this model of life that I developed in the earlier stages, drawing on the logic and on the phenomenology, is really a model of, you know, what do we think about a living, how do we get from a living individual, you or I, to a conception of the whole cycle of life of which we are a part, right? So it's a lot of it's this question of like, okay, we find ourselves as these living individuals with all these organs and functions. And he asks, you know, where did these come from? And he develops in his, you know, logic, philosophy of nature and elsewhere, an account of how those have developed as a result of our interaction with an external environment. It's not quite like Darwin, but it's like a little bit, he's got enough of that. It's by assimilating the external environment, by producing things in the external environment and taking that back in, adapting ourselves to the external environment, that we've developed into the kind of creatures that we are. And then in the third stage of the cycle of life, he develops an account of reproduction, of why you need to have a two selves who then can reproduce the species and so on. So there's a kind of biological model of life that then he thinks, because that is this amazing self-contained whole, we can take that as really our standard for any kind of rational system. So anything that's going to be fully rational is going to have this form of life as a living system. And the family is no exception to that. In fact, it's the most obvious example of it. The family, civil society, and the state are all going to be these living institutions. And then the whole system of ethical life as this ensemble of institutions is itself going to be one big living system that is the system of justice. But in the family, I mean, there's, I don't know, should I stop for a second? There's questions about the internal structure of the family, purpose of the family in reproducing itself, that then exemplify these moments. But can I say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, before you do, I mean, because I would love it, but just sort of on this broader topic of thinking about the developmental structure of the of ethical life. I mean, it's a lot like Aristotle, right? Is the other relevant comparison, you know, a political thinker who conceives of a political order in developmental terms, right? In contrast to the social contract theorists who think about it in artifactual terms, right? So Aristotle's view is that you start with a family because that's the basic biological need for self-preservation and propagation. Then you move to sort of like agglomeration of families into a village, and which satisfies life simply or mere life. And then the association of villages into a city, which satisfies the good life, not just mere life. So, you know, Hegel's clearly drawing on Aristotle in a certain way, although, I mean, we'll talk about civil society in a minute, which is certainly different than Aristotle's view of the village. But I find it often interesting to sort of compare and contrast Hegel and Aristotle on this point. I didn't know if you had any thoughts about, you know, if that's And clearly there's like, you know, Hegel's updating the biology, right? So it's almost quasi-Darwinian in a way that Aristotle certainly didn't, you know, has much more of a strict teleological story to tell. But I don't know if that's sort of helpful to set the stage here.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally helpful and totally relevant. I mean, there's lots of places where Hegel seems to indicate that Aristotle is basically his most important predecessor. I mean, and I think this is certainly one of those cases. I mean, I think, you know, a bunch of people have tried to do that recently, sort of talk about the Aristotelian forms of energeia and actualization is exactly what Hegel is taking on in this notion of realization. And I mean, the word expression, which I use a lot and other people have used to describe Hegel, has now become really associated with modernity, like because of the self-expressive individual. But really it's picking up this older notion of the realization of potential in Aristotle. And so I think, yeah, there's ways in which I probably make Hegel seem more modern, less Aristotelian than he is, but that's only because I think the Aristotelian elements are so present that if we don't do that, we're going to just be like, oh, he's just doing Aristotle.
All right. But the difference, I mean, I take it what the expressive thing points out is that there's no essence that precedes the development of the concept, right? It's not like already built into the seed that the tree fully grows. That part of what the tree becomes is the actual interaction with the environment as it grows, right? So that's what I take it as, like picking up on the modern, that picks up and that's why it's essentially different than the Aristotelian approach, where like the blueprint is already built into the seed, I guess, to mix metaphors badly.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think, you know, in the first chapter, I talk a little bit about the chapter 4, the phenomenology, to say how we get from being merely natural beings to these free beings and the master-servant struggle and so on. And a big part of that account is to say, yes, we start with human needs, right? And that Hegel's, and I hope I've really brought that to the fore, how central the concept of needs is to Hegel. And he does start with the natural needs and they remain central throughout the account. But he's also always thinking about the ways in which we're these indeterminate animals that can disrupt our own needs and can go in different directions, so that there's not one sort of way in which we grow and flourish. And yet, to get back to the family, I mean, that's the sort of paradox of the modern family, is that it exists in order to dissolve itself, in a sense, right? That he's opposed to the clan family because he thinks you raise your kids so that they can leave and become their own people and start their own families. I mean, that's apart from the gender issues in Hegel's family, which are the best thing you can say about them is they're not as bad as Fichte, but that's not saying very much. But so what I do try to say, and you know, again, this is a little bit of a ideal theory approach, but not entirely, about the family is like, so it's really important to my account of these living institutions that we have what I call the equivalence of rights and duties. So there's a couple really important passages where Hegel says in ethical life, you have rights insofar as you have duties and duties insofar as you have rights. And it's kind of hard to figure out exactly what he means by that. And what I want to say the concept of value really helps us figure out is that, look, your duty like and your right are not exactly the same thing. Like there are different, if you think about your right in an institution as sort of like how your interests are satisfied in that institution, and you think of your duties as your obligation to that institution, this isn't all of what that means, but a very big and neglected part of what that means is that insofar as you do your duty and give to the institution, you get back from the institution as right, the benefit equivalent in value to what you put into it. So I try to say this is not as transactional as it sounds, and there's a long story about that in here. But in the marriage situation, it does open a way to say, okay, look, Hegel has lots of good things to say about the reciprocity of husband and wife in the marriage. And that's good. And then he goes on to talk about women as plants and fixed roles and bad things. But he has this core kind of mutual recognition and reciprocity within the marriage. And that sort of sets the terms for this equivalence within the marriage so that each person's work within the marriage counts as work, and that they therefore can make claims about imbalances within the institution that need to be redressed somehow. So that I try to set out a sort of standard. It's not a really kind of fixed standard, but it's one that kind of makes sense of the idea of what justice in the family would look like if, like, childcare work was recognized as work and given a value that then could be balanced out with what the other partner in the marriage brings to it, such that we could have a conception of justice within even that institution of marriage that would set a certain kind of standard for what each has to contribute to it.
Yeah, this is a great example to help illustrate, I think, what you were saying earlier about the ways in which that, Hegel's political philosophy would serve as a form of criticism against empirical state policies, right? I mean, sometimes there's a longstanding reading of Hegel's philosophy, right, as extremely conservative, which is not a reading that typically most scholars take anymore. But in part because, I think you rightly point out, this, the way that Hegel develops his view of the good can serve as a way of criticizing existing institutions, that they're not living up to their own way in which they conceive of the good, which is, I think, particularly powerful in the case of the family, where issues about not living a full life are particularly poignant and powerful in expressing, say, like rights for care workers, in contrast to just mere abstract right, which doesn't have quite the punch. So, appealing to the, sort of overall purpose or aim of institutions in order to ground justice, as opposed to just sort of having a kind of abstract claim to justice be brought to bear as, in a kind of contractualist vein. I don't know. I mean, it does seem to me to be more powerful of a way to, and more promising of a way to kind of bring together incompatible claims.
Yeah, I mean, it's true that, Hegel can sometimes give the impression of, wanting to have his cake and eat it too, where he says, of course, Kant's idea of marriage as a contract is reprehensible and terrible, and marriage is not like that at all. And then two paragraphs later, he'll say, well, of course, marriage has to be made official, and you have to sign it. And so it does look a little bit like a contract. And but you can see what he's trying to do, which is, again, going back to this structure that I mentioned earlier of kind of like moments and whole. Like, he wants to say, yeah, there's a moment, there's like all these moments or different aspects of marriage. And, having property within marriage is one of them, and having it officially recognized legally is one of them. And having sexual relations is one of them, but none of them are absolutely essential except the overall purpose of like loving and caring each other for each other. So it's like, I think it's really right what he does there, even though it makes it harder to have short conversations, to say, there's a purpose for the whole institution, a struct, kind of shape of that purpose of the whole institution of marriage and family. Let's take family as a whole. And within that, there's going to be all of these finer structures that give that institution its differentiated shape. And don't focus on any single one of those to the exclusion of the others. Keep them all under this overarching purpose. And if you can do that, then you can kind of make these claims that have to do with justice within the the marriage. But as I say, it's marriage is, I mean, family is a really tricky case, because when it comes to this equivalence of rights and duties, because you don't really get those determined unless there's like a divorce proceeding, right? So it's like, you know, you, and maybe there are married couples out there who are keeping books on each other's contributions to the marriage, or maybe they should be. But as a matter of fact, it's not built into the institution itself, as say it should be into economic relations, that you actually debate about, keep track of, officially keep track of what people are getting paid and so on. And so that a lot of the negotiations within families are gonna have to have this unofficial status, which makes them again liable to abuse. But as the immediate form of ethical life, that's also, you know, part of their character.
I mean, it could be, you could imagine a circumstance in which, you know, citizens are asked to account for, you know, what proportion of housework do men and women do, right? You often see these charts in which it turns out that, you know, women still do way more housework than men do. So you could conceive of a policy that seeks to sort of equalize that by having citizens give an account. So what would Hegel say to something like that? I mean, would he think that that introduces, you know, the wrong kind of logic into the family, that it displaces immediate relationships and makes them liable to a form of, you know, commercial mere contractual exchange? Or,
well, I think you're really touching on the, you know, the relation of family and civil society, and I think he doesn't say enough about it. So, like, in civil society, we have all these estates. Corporations are kind of a state. Anyway, there's labor groups, let's say, groups organized according to their occupation or their labor. Now, I think I think it could be very much the case that care workers, including, you know, parents who stay at home to care for their own children, could be considered one of these estates or groups who should have a say, officially a say, within the economic and political order. I mean, I think that's where you'd have to make the alteration within, or the addition within the confines of Hegel's system, in order to get that to work. So yeah, because I think he does think the principles of family and civil society are separate, because he thinks civil society really is self-interested, and at least in its most basic form, it has a character that's almost antithetical to the family. But I don't see why there's, given especially that his overall view is that all of these institutions should be supporting each other, I don't think it would be, and because I actually think his view about labor is a pretty good one, I think there's definitely a place, there could be a place within his theory to say, look, there should be something, maybe not a, like a union, but quasi-union, a group that represents care workers of all sorts, which people staying at home to care for their own children would be a key part, who would then set some kind of standards for compensation of one sort or another of the work that's done by those care workers.
Yeah, so the civil society section of the philosophy of right, I often thought of this as maybe exemplifying best what you've pointed out as sort of Hegel's mediation between a kind of idealistic utopian and realistic approach to politics. I mean, it's very realistic in the sense that it begins, as you say, with self-interested individuals pursuing their own good. But then it ends with the sort of integration of individuals into the estates and corporations, these communities that educate and provide recognition and support for their members, and then ultimately transitions into a kind of political representation in the state. So it's a way in which, you know, you begin with a kind of realistic approach to politics that It begins, as modern thinkers do, with commercial relationships, but ends with a kind of, you know, form of solidarity that, you know, doesn't come out of thin air that you might think in more utopian thinkers, but sort of emerges through this, the development of commercial relationships. So I've often found that to be particularly powerful in Hegel's view, and it seems you do too. I mean, I'm curious about how you think about, you know, some of the you know, moments in civil society that you know, are less than savory, such as, you know, his view of colonialism or his view of poverty, and how these, you know, do you think Hegel can be redeemed from criticisms against them, or how do you think about those moments when civil society seems to run aground?
Right. Yeah. No. So I mean, like I was saying, I have this view of the living institution, and the family is the first version of that, and the state is the overarching version of it. But in the middle, you have what looks like a sort of anti-institution, like everybody for themselves in civil society. At least that's where it starts. And where he ends up is giving a pretty strong argument, I think, for what's called die Polizei, as translated as the police, but it's really sort of like public regulation that provides welfare rights and is supposed to, you know, make sure that nobody slips below a certain line and so on. So a pretty good account of that. I mean, he doesn't give enough detail of it, but I think there's plenty of resources there to make a strong account for welfare rights of various kinds, especially healthcare rights. But then the passages that get all the attention are the ones about the colonialism and the rabble. And what do we make of those? I mean, part of it is, I think, part of me thinks Hegel is just being honest and, again, realistic in a sense that this is what modern economies do. And then there's a question about, I mean, this is what the logic of the modern economy leads to. And then there's a question of, well, shouldn't that have led him to reject the modern capitalist principle altogether if this is its logical result? And then the question would be like, well, then he would have had to come up with an alternative that would reinvent modern economics. And I don't think he thought that he was in a position to do that, besides the fact that he thinks individual choice is so important to modern life, even though, again, he like kind of criticizes it at various prominent places. The role for individual choice is all over this text. And so he certainly belongs in the modern liberal tradition, and he doesn't see any way to get around that. And so I think in part, he just throws up his hands, and his solution of colonialism is obviously not a solution. It just happened to be the one that lots of European powers seem to be embarking on. I think you could say, I mean, as I sometimes say about Fichte's closed commercial state, well, that was another attempt to solve this problem. It didn't really work so well either and had lots of strange aspects to it. But it, yeah, I think that just remains the central problem of modern institutional life. You have business and market forces that the state is not really in a position to control, and yet it must control them somehow. And Hegel seemed to rely on I gather, not entirely true to the facts account of the corporation and the estates. I mean, it seemed like, from what I know about German history, which is not a ton, this picture of the corporations and the estates he gives is already a bit romantic or dated. Like, these were on their way out. We could see what was coming, which was a much less cohesive version of capitalist production. And Hegel just sort of clung to the old ones and said, look, if you don't have some sort of grouping, labor groups like this, your whole political system is going to fall apart. And so to me, that today seems like an argument for you really need strong labor organization, or else the whole system's going to fall apart. And yeah, that it remains to be seen if there's anything other than lots of hard work that would take to actually bring that about.
Right. And I've often thought about this too, what Hegel's view of civil society, especially these states and corporations, would look like today. I mean, is your sense that it would be like unions, that is, worker organized and developed, or would it be sort of state facilitated? Would it involve a combination of management and workers? I mean, it seems like this, on Hegel's view, it can't simply just be the workers, it has to be sort of at least state, in dialogue with the state and management and labor combined. But do you have thoughts? I mean, sometimes people ask me, what's an example of like a good Hegelian estate or corporation today? And I don't know, I have a tough time answering that question.
Yeah, you don't. I mean, the stuff that comes after this is relevant. Like when he starts talking about the different powers in the state, it's true that he thinks anytime you have completely hostile powers, something has gone wrong. And so if he took like a union that, whose sole purpose was to pit themselves against management to get as much the best deal they could out of management, and that these are just like two opposing forces, I think, yeah, he would have some reservations about that. His picture of the corporations involves like having government officials participate in the corporations and then having the corporations participate in politics. And I mean, you can, I live in Philadelphia now, and you can see weird and not especially encouraging versions of this in like city politics in cities that have strong trade unions, where you find the trade union heads appearing in the newspaper with politicians, and then you're always kind of wondering, like, is this really the way things are supposed to be going? And then the head of the electricians union is being investigated by the federal government. And so there's like definitely like the ways in which you could implement this today are sort of hard to see. I mean, there was a syndicalist movement that people now who could have claimed the syndicalist mantle that maybe are a little bit closer to Hegel's view. I think the key thing is that Hegel, and one thing I'm trying to get across in this book, although I do have to talk a lot about various metaphysical concepts, is that the notion of an interest for Hegel is absolutely central. And his whole politics really is based, even though it's got a lot of moving parts, it really comes down to people's interests. And so if you don't organize people according to their economic interests in civil society, and then find a way to channel that collective organization as an interest group into the political process, he thinks the whole notion of a sort of organic system of justice is going to fall apart. But I would take it that a key part of that for him would be, living wage and all of those things that that we think would make for a more just society for the people who are at the lower end of the spectrum. I think that solution seems to me to be the right one. I mean, yes, I think he does have a kind of safety net picture, a sort of social welfare backstop to things, but then he doesn't think that can solve all our problems, because the rabble, he acknowledges, is still gonna arise. And so the question is how you give people a sense of belonging, and he thought you could do it through their work. And that still seems to me pretty plausible as a candidate, or at least a better candidate than Facebook groups or whatever might be the ascendant forms of belonging today.
No, me too. Especially because it's a form of belonging that has a universal purpose, as it were. It's not an identity group that is particular and determinate and distinct from other groups, but it's, about a universal purpose for the common good of everyone. Right. And that gets us to the state, indeed the transition from civil society to the state, which again, there's lots of sort of seemingly crazy things that Hegel says about the state, you know, like the famous march of God in the world. Of course, yeah, no Hegel scholars anymore think of this in kind of fascist terms that it used to be conceived of. But I guess one of the questions is if it's not that, but yet Hegel wants to maintain some importance for the state. What is it that distinguishes it from civil society or from a social contract view of the state, right? Another way to put it is if we've got more of a deflated picture of Hegel's view of the state, that it's not the end all and be all of human life for its members, but it's more like a kind of social democratic view. It seems like it not much then distinguishes Hegel's view from the social contract theory tradition after all, right? What in your view, like, sort of distinguishes it from that?
Yeah, I mean, I have a little bit of a discussion of Fred Neuhauser's view that you can basically get most of what's good in Hegel. You can assimilate most of what's good about Hegel to the social contract tradition, and some of his criticisms are misguided, and properly read as a Rousseauian social contract theorist, we can kind of make Hegel one, and there's nothing really incompatible about them. And I think there's a fair amount to that view. Like I'll say where I finally end up taking issue with that in a minute. But I guess just to go back to the language of the march of God in the world, like this goes back to the, you know, what I was saying about the good and the at the beginning of ethical life. Like, so I mean, you just have to picture Hegel thinking about Kant's moral theory, in which the highest good is, you know, the realization of happiness and duty together, and thinking, and why, what, how do we get the highest good? By postulating God. That's all in Kant. And then you just think Hegel is just simply transposing all of that to the real world. And that just seems crystal clear to me as what Hegel is doing. And whether rhetorically that was smart or whether he, you know, exactly the sense in which he means to think that politics and religion should be on the same page, which he does think. If we have time, I could say a few words about that. But in the end, what it means is that justice should rule, that the good should be realized, that value should be configured in a way that is, that we have a just society. And
the state is the thing that does that most reliably.
Say that again?
Well, the state is the thing in the modern age that does that most reliably.
Yeah,
that exactly. That fulfills those ends, yeah.
Exactly, so he's trying to bring that all down to earth. But then he's also, methodologically, I think he's just gonna say, look, this comes from the concept of the free will, not from anybody's punctual consent. So, I mean, it's true that not every social contract theory is gonna rest so much on that punctual consent. But if it doesn't, then it's unclear to me whether it really remains a social contract theory or not. That's one thing to say. The other thing would be, so Neuhauser's argument about, like, a social contract theorist can justify, like, dying for your country. I think that's the test case he uses at the end of the day. Hegel thinks you can't get that. Rousseau seems to think he could get that. So why not? That seems to belong to one of your fundamental interests, to live in a state and therefore to die in defense of the state. And what I do say there, and this is, this may not be a claim in defense of Hegel, this may count against him for a lot of people, is that I think Hegel will be able to say, unlike that version of social contract theory, that it's this state in particular that you belong to, that constitutes who you are, that you're willing to die for. So I think in the contractualist element, it's got to be a state, at least in the way Neuhauser's presenting it there, whereas I think Hegel can get you the specificity of this state. Now, there is a worry that that can then feed into the kind of nationalism that would be such a disaster for Europe. 20th century, but I think it does sort of distinguish, I mean, the Hegelian concept as focusing on this individuality of this state is something you can't really get out of the social contract tradition.
Yeah, I mean, just the time's running short, so I want to maybe bring into dialogue, you know, Rawls, who makes appearances throughout your book, and in certain ways, just to kind of focus things, because I guess one way to ask this question is, you know, Rawls has a lot in common with Hegel in various areas. Obviously, a lot in common with Kant, with this sort of, you know, his constructivist procedure of ethics, but he has a lot in common too with Hegel, as you know point out. He has this sort of reflective equilibrium methodological view of, you know, sort of comparing our intuitions against general principles and sort of, you know, been going back and forth and revising them, and that's kind of quasi Hegelian in a way. And he has a, you know, Rawls in his later work has a kind of, you know, view of the, you know, ideal end society that we're pointing to. You know, I guess one question is why in what way is Hegel better than Rawls? Or like, you know, why shouldn't we be a sort of Rawlsian contractualist? Why should we take up Hegel rather than being Rawlsian contractualists if Rawls sort of appropriates what's best in Hegel and avoids this kind of potential for nationalism and the, you know, sort of weird rigidity of Hegel's overall organicist vision?
Yeah, it's a good
and question. Hegel's perfectionism too. I mean, so you could be a political liberal, you shouldn't be a perfectionist. Yeah.
I don't think Hegel's a perfectionist, so I'd be curious. You'll be curious to hear more about that later.
Oh, okay. I just mean that he's, you know, he puts the good as central to politics rather than the right.
Yeah, that's right. But he doesn't think that any particular individual, realizes the good in themselves, or that perfection is that should be the goal of any individual. I mean, he doesn't even think perfection should be the goal of the state. I mean, I think, yes, teleological, yes, our goal is to realize the good, but there's, along with that, all sorts of recognitions of limitations. I mean, the fact that he's, one of his main programmatic goals is to unite interest and duty so that he's not inclined to sacrifice interest to duty. This is puts him really at odds with Kant and Fichte, I think. But back to your question about why we shouldn't be Rawlsians. I mean, I guess partly one thing to say is what I said in relation to your question about, or what I was saying about Neuhauser and Rousseau, is that in the end, I don't know that Rawls is a contractualist himself. I mean, that whole, it's just a, you know, divisive representation. And, you know, I actually quoted Charles Larmor's comment on Rawls, that what's really important to Rawls is reciprocity or mutual recognition. So that makes Rawls even more of a Hegelian than he seems to be on the face of it. I mean, I guess a couple key differences are, one, like, Hegel's not into giving like principles. Like, he's not going to say, okay, here are your principles of justice, and then the question is just like, how do you apply them in society? So that whole idea that like justice can be derived from a couple principles is just going to be way too abstract for him. And that leads to this other element that we were just talking about you know, belonging to labor groups and other groups, and thinking about this identity, this kind of unity of society in terms of these interlocking or mutually complementary groups, is just not really clearly something you can fit into the Rawlsian project. And so I think you just get it's true, I'm inclined mostly to read them as pretty close and complementary. I do think there's a real fundamental difference in the Rawlsian view of kind of the individual as the unit of account, and the sense in Hegel that really, as you get deeper into the account, every individual is going to be part of a host of different groups, And that it's belonging to those groups that's going to really do the work of justice more than any kind of calculation that you could do just with individuals.
Yeah, well, there's so much more in this book that I wish we had a chance to talk about. Talk about the constitution of the rational state, right? And the legislative, executive, and the monarch. Talk about the international relations and world history. And unfortunately, time is short. We never have enough time to talk about everything, but I encourage you all to read it. And, you know, let me say once again, Dean, thanks so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thanks a lot for having me.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.